An English woman who was the wife of an English Tommy, a soldier who was stationed in Egypt at the moment. She had never done anything on anything, but they asked me to train her to be my boss. So I went to see the head of Egyptian State Radio. I emphasize Egyptian State Radio. And he was an Englishman because at the time it was being run by Marconi. And I said to him, can I do the job or not? He said, of course, you've been doing it beautifully. I said, well, why don't you give me the job? He said, we'll give you an assistant, but you can't have either the title or the salary. So I said, why not? And the answer was, I'm sorry, but we cannot give such a responsible job to an Egyptian, in Egyptian State Radio. So I didn't even answer. I turned tail, I walked out of the building, and I haven't been inside that building since then. And that was 50-something years ago.
Wings started when I started to work at Western Public Radio in San Francisco as the operations manager. And I told the guy who was going to hire me, I said, listen, if you're just looking for a secretary, don't hire me, because I had just been fired from a secretarial job because they said I didn't have appropriate clerical demeanor. So anyway, he said, no, I want somebody who'll do projects. I said, really? What kind of projects? He said, anything you want. I said, okay, I'll take the job.
The reason why I think that the radios I have been involved with on a longer term basis, or just as an observer, an evaluator, an impact assessment person, the reason is that the radios are starting where people are, and a lot of the radios work on the basis of identification of dreams. Where do we want to go? Instead of focusing on what problems do we have and how can we solve them, to say what is our dream and how can we get there. And that is immensely motivating.
During a recent gathering of community radio producers for the National Community Radio Conference in Ottawa, community and campus producers were invited to share experiences and discuss gender equality and women's rights in the Canadian and international media landscape in a roundtable discussion with Executive Director of UN Women, Fumzile Mlambo Nuka. During our interview, which will be featured throughout this documentary, Fumzile emphasized the responsibility community radio producers in Canada have to tell women's stories and to support the development of women community broadcasters. Throughout this documentary, the lines often blur between a collective telling of the legacy and future of community radio globally and community radio in action as a whistleblower and veil remover and in general community server. There are tips and tricks found here that give insight into the thought processes that possessed us uppity women, as we used to say, to track down these stories, most often with that essential humanitarian perspective. It is my hopes that these thoughts will guide and inspire up-and-coming women producers that will further elevate our collective voices. There are many organizations mentioned throughout this documentary that are worth a second look, as we say. Likewise, where possible, I have preserved the voices of the original interviewers so as to acknowledge the vast effort made by women to tell our stories around the world.
I am Phumzile Mlambo Nuka, Executive Director of UN Women. Glad to be here, both to learn and to share about the important work and role of community radio stations.
Ani Bojo Tanse Mishin Dengwe Anquad Kwandishnakaz. My name is Gabrielle Fant, originally from Alberta, and I live here in Ottawa, which is on unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin territory. And I help host Machif Hour, which is part of the Aboriginal CKCU programming at Carleton University. So I'm very grateful to be here today. So miigwech, hi for having me.
Hello, my name is Sarah Newton. In the community radio sector in Canada, we have a gender-neutral and gender-balanced board of directors and have for some time now. I got my start in broadcasting on a women's radio collective, which is exciting, but I'm also eager to participate today because I think there's a long distance we can travel still, and I'm looking forward to highlighting some of those issues and as well as hearing about your work around the world. Welcome.
And my name's Gretchen. I'm teching today's show. I'm also an activist in the community radio sector for more than 15 years and actually came to my first National Campus Community Radio Conference, which opens this week in Ottawa, more than 10 years ago to participate in a Women in Radio track. I work today for the Community Media Advocacy Center, which works for Indigenous and community media in Canada. I also am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Ottawa, where I'm researching equity in newsrooms, also building on my PhD research, which was on community radio measurements and looking at the impacts of the work that we do.
My name is Nikki, and I also am part of the staff here on CHUO. I'm the resource development coordinator, so I work in a lot of the marketing, promotion, social media, and partnerships that we have here at CHUO. I also host a two-hour show called Radioactive with Nikki, so I'm really excited to delve into this conversation and discuss the equality of women in this sector. My first question for you, Fumzile, would be to ask, what was your interest in interviewing us as radio broadcasters?
Probably not so much to interview than to have a conversation, because in many countries, the mainstream broadcasters are not really focused on empowering women and addressing the issues that are dear to women. And community radio stations have been pioneers in identifying issues that are key to communities. And because you are younger people, you are the new generation of community radio broadcasters, we are keen to learn from your experiences, how you're pushing the frontiers. If you were in our position, what are some of the issues that you'd be putting on the table? So I'm not here as an expert. I'm really here to learn from your experiences, which I think are quite dynamic and different from those of people of my age group.
Your answer really opens us up to a lot of dialogue. And one thing that's been on my mind as an Indigenous person is here on Turtle Island, before settlers arrived on Turtle Island, we didn't just have two gender roles. We didn't just have male or woman. Some communities had up to 13 different genders. In our languages today, many Indigenous languages, they don't have male or female. Those are things that have evolved after colonization. My curiosity is about, how can we include Two-Spirit people? How can we include people that are trans, people that don't necessarily identify as women? How can we include them in the conversation?
I don't think that there's one answer to this, but the one part of the answer is respect for everybody, irrespective of what both their choices and preferences are, and making sure that through our informal and community education, through our parenting, we visually demonstrate the need for that respect and acceptance. In many traditional communities, people used stories to ensure that there is inclusivity. They also, in many communities, if I think about communities in Africa, for instance, celebrations, special occasions where different people are given an opportunity in dance, in music, in song, in food, you get to celebrate the variety that is there in communities. And I think the more we open ourselves to make culture a rich part of our heritage, whatever society you come from, we create an opportunity for everybody to belong. In some communities, age is revered. That's part of being inclusive. When you have people that have got exceptional talent, you sit around and you marvel. That's part of affirming them. But also when you have got people who've got limitation, it could be a disability, you create an opportunity to cherish that. When you have people that are able to, I think in the modern language you'd say, it is a tomboy, or people who have just multiple talent that you cannot say this is a boy or a girl, or you create a special way of celebrating that. And I think that was a way in which traditionally our societies were able to do that. And I think we've got to find a way of fusing that in modern society, where we have to fill in forms. Are you a man or a woman? What's your race? What's your gender? And that really boxes everybody into a very limited space.
Frieda Linfield Worden is an American and Canadian radio producer. She is the co-founder and producer of WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, which debuted in 1986 and has been in wide syndication for more than 27 years. Produced by and about women, WINGS broadcasts on non-commercial radio stations worldwide. Throughout this documentary, interviews gathered from WINGS broadcasts that focus on the role of community radio in developing women's positions in communities around the world are featured.
Today on WINGS, Frieda Pigru of Ghana, a newly elected board member of the Africa region of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters. Pigru will also represent West and Central Africa in AMARC's Women's International Network. In the 1990s, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, known by its French acronym AMARC, developed a Women's International Network, known by its English acronym WIN. At the 2015 AMARC International Conference, Frieda Pigru was chosen to represent West and Central Africa to the Women's International Network.
When I started to do a female program on the radio station, it is men coming to sit and discuss women issues when they don't really know how the women felt. So at one time, I had the opportunity to talk to one of the women at the hospital, and I introduced myself to her and told her I wanted to invite her for a program. So at first she was feeling reluctant to come, but I told her that, oh, it's nothing. I just want you to be a role model to the other women. When you start it, others will see and would be interested to start. So she promised to come. And the first week we organized the program and she didn't come. And then the second time, I met the other woman. And she said the first woman came to her and told her she was invited to the program. But she was scared. She has never been to the radio station before. So I told them that, okay, maybe they can talk to each other. Because they said without a man, the men in their homes or their husbands will feel that they have just come to talk against men. So we had to lobby for a man to come and help and support them to talk about the issues. And that was how we got a man and then those two women to be the panel for the program that day. And after that, the feedback from the community was good. And then we decided to keep it running.
My name is Pegida Yellow. I have a strategically oriented communications degree, which led me to want to know more about journalism. So I worked 5 years as a journalist. I was part of starting the first community radio in Denmark, was part of the women's collective there. We also did a lot of community organizing work and using radio and TV in different ways. And I was going to write my thesis at that time, and what was more obvious than doing it about women's access and women's use of community radio? And we used all of these theories about women's productivity and women's aesthetics, and how it was important to create space for women in public arenas like theater and, of course, the job area, but in the cultural sense also in the media and community radio. At the same time, I moved more and more into using communication for development. I moved to Mozambique in 98 with my family to run a media development program that was initiated by the UN system and funded by a number of bilateral donors in order to assist Mozambique in its reform process of the media after moving from socialism to a multi-party democracy. Created a lot of community radios. When we started, there were 4. 6 years later, there were 50. So those were 6 exciting years in Southern Africa. One of my preoccupations, concerns, and irritations has always been that you take all these initiatives, you support all these projects, you may even start radios, you work a lot on programming, but very little attention has been paid to what kind of impact does that actually have in reality. It's good if the community radio is participatory and transparent and with a lot of community involvement. That's wonderful and important. It's necessary that you do programs that are adequate and needed and provide the information and the platforms and the voice and the debate that you need. But what does all of that do? There's a reason why we do all of that, and that is to improve living conditions. And it has been striking that when I've been carrying out these impact assessments, the first thing that comes out in women's groups and even often in men's groups when you talk with them is since the radio came, women's conditions have been improved. Women are being beaten up a lot less. And I'm asking, but why? And are you sure this has to do with the radio? And one of the very strong stories I got was from a dry, poor, really pressured community in southwest Kenya, a radio run by 33 women's groups. And they said, well, the first way we did was that when the men are beating up their women, it's usually after they've been drinking. So they went to the bar in the evening with a tape recorder and they talked with the men and they were saying a lot of silly, foolish things. And then they put them on air the next day. And they became so embarrassed with themselves. Actually, also the problem with drinking, with having girlfriends and all of these related issues became much less serious. And well, women were beaten up less, but it also meant softer lives for children who were both beaten up and abused in other ways. Finally, we are seen as real human beings. This was what was selected as the most significant change in this community. In one reality, in an African country, women were regularly not allowed to leave the house. So after the radio came, and it has been debated on the radio, and men felt kind of embarrassed keeping their women away and so on, the doors became easier to open. But the radio and the women's network in the radio, in order for all the reasons that I've talked about before, this movement had become a facilitating factor in them starting to shake up their lives, to work together and to find a way out of even much more complicated life situations that they were in before. So that was a very powerful change, and men were extremely happy. Suddenly one of them said, you know, I never thought about that my wife or the woman in my life, that she could be my partner. I look at her with completely new eyes.
Also, while we were in Ottawa, the United Nations Association was meeting at the same facility we were to discuss recommendations submitted to the House of Commons Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Development, analyzing the roles of women in areas dealing with extreme conflict. I caught up with Kate White, President and CEO of the United Nations Association in Canada and Chair of the World Federation of United Nations Associations. I asked her to share her knowledge about the contributions made by community radio producers in assisting the United Nations in achieving the Sustainable Development Goals.
Community radio has been vital to development, including to the promotion of democracy and inclusion in, again, both vast and important ways and in very small transformative ways in communities. Of course, we saw this in a brutal and heartbreaking way in Rwanda as well. And I would say to you, the largest argument for the engagement and recognition of the power of community radio is to look at how it was able to foment a violent conflict and seen as this opportunity. How do we change that now in reaching out and telling the stories of women? Multiculturalism and multimedia addressed exactly the role of the media, including radio, in saying not only do we have to see diversity at the microphone, but we have to see women in the field as interviewers. We have to see producers and people behind the mic, that there's inclusion, that they're using and learning the techniques and technology of community radio as well. And I think this is a real opportunity for community radio. In fact, I'm going to give you a pitch for the Sustainable Development Goals and challenge community radio in Canada to say, how can we show leadership and how can we do knowledge sharing both with community radio in developed countries, but in developing countries as well, and contribute to the suite of 17 goals that was universally adopted by the international community. And the objective here was to learn from the promising practices and the challenges of the Millennium Development Goals that went before them. Again, the Millennium Development Goals that informed them was the first time the international community said, collectively, we need to look at all of the development funding that we send around the world and be more coherent. In other words, so that we're all singing from the same song sheet. What is it that we must do? Overarchingly, the Millennium Development Goals and the Sustainable Development Goals are about eliminating poverty. The goals themselves are aspirational in the very key ways that we agree that we move forward to achieve those goals. And in fact, this goes back to the importance of community radio. It is, by its very definition, accessible. And in fact, I'm going to throw it out through your listeners to say community members too. The difference with the Sustainable Development Goals is we haven't said, as we did with the Millennium Development Goals, it's about the global south. You must do this. You must integrate gender equality. You must address global poverty. You must address hunger. Rather, we've said these are universal goals. It means that each of us has a responsibility to look around our communities and say, what can each of us do to make a difference? And I will tell you, even in our modest office, we're challenging each other about our consumption and production. You know, do we really need to feed the beast that is keeping people impoverished? And we have, on this morning, where we have seen such unspeakable violence, where we have celebrated the end of Eid with, again, violence in Dhaka and Paris and other places, that this is a moment for each of us to say, what are my aspirations to do something that will transform my neighbor, my family, my school, my workplace, my country, my world.
This documentary would not be complete if we did not acknowledge the bravery and sacrifice women journalists have made on the front lines, regardless of accolades. The following montage of clips were introduced during a Wings episode dedicated to featuring the lives of women journalists working within a variety of media frameworks.
It is quite common for women journalists that actually will go to a conflict zone to report on the human dimension. They will have much more of a focus on refugee issues, on perhaps women and children issues, general civilian issues. On the one hand, this is a good thing because they would make very good combinations in teams. On the other hand, might make them more vulnerable because they might actually go into areas in order to get these stories that might be slightly more risky.
I had to go to New York to work there for a while, and I found the book written by American journalist women who had covered the Vietnam War. And in that book, one of them said, every time somebody asks me about what is being a woman in a war, I always answer, I don't know, because I've never been a man, so I cannot compare.
There's a lot of censorship. Besides censorship, there is a lot of intimidation. It's been a very rough patch in my life, and for some reason I was even tempted to quit. Not just quit because I'm done with journalism, but like I wanted to hide for my life, and I fear for my family members, my husband and kids, because you never know who's behind this threat. Like, I tried reporting the whole matter to the police, and this is not the first time that I'm getting threats. But very unfortunately, nothing has been done. At a certain stage, I was sexually harassed in broad daylight by a member of parliament, and the person he was with was the prime minister's son. But you just won't believe me. To date, the matter has not been addressed. The investigating officer who took up on my case was transferred with immediate effect. And to date, I just have the number for the case, but nothing has happened. So I don't really feel safe.
I would rather to be named as Sattar, the young blogger who has been killed in Iran prison.
Someone told me I am not a smiling woman anymore. but I cannot feel free while others are being held captive. In terms of other women that have been kidnapped, they should not feel alone. During the month I was a prisoner, emotions were very high, and I was very confused. But some news came to me, and the thought that many were calling for my release helped. Solidarity helped.
Найбільша країна у межах Європи. Земля, відома своїми родючими ґрунтами, і що століттями вважалася житницею Європи. Батьківщина милозвучної мови, жвавого танцю та одного з найперших античних суспільств – трипільців. Україна.
Women in almost all societies face discrimination. If they go to work, they will be underpaid. The fact that the global average pay gap is 24%, and that is true of the richest and the poorest countries. Why is it that you find this in every country, irrespective of their level of development or whether they have a constitution that enshrines gender equality? It is because prejudice is so deep. So you still find this inequality everywhere, because even if you've got laws, you've got education, you've got laws that support equality, the prejudice that is within in society is very deep. And when we reviewed the 20 years of implementing the Beijing platform, one thing that we discovered was that in our vigorous implementation of that important agreement, we did not do enough to address directly prejudice and norms that reinforce gender inequality. We passed good laws, but we did not remove bad practice.
Then I take very seriously my responsibility to represent an alternative wherever we work, whatever our gender, our religious belief, our sexuality. We have to recognize that there are opportunities for us to speak of it at the right moment to liberate and inspire others.
Think of the context in terms of the colonial history of Canada, but also a colonial history that's rooted in anti-blackness, and that white supremacist historical founding of Canada has so many repercussions today. So when we think about women in the workplace and equity in the numbers that have been achieved, we don't necessarily have the measures in place to document what the experiences have been. Are those women in managerial roles? Are they in senior positions? For example, we have a campus community radio sector that 10 plus years ago we did some research, but there's been no follow-up research to say, have stations actually implemented FemCon, which is supposed to highlight femme artists, women identified artists in Canada? There's a gender equity toolkit. Has it been used? Is it being used? What's been the impact of it? Where it's been applied in the campus community radio sector? So we don't have that data. In addition to that, where data does come through, it speaks to the lack of participation of women, especially when you think of the Canadian Communication, Television and Telecommunication Commission, which regulates radio in Canada. There's been some few, 26% of women appointed to that commission, and there's only been one chair of that commission, so the one that kind of runs the whole thing, the CEO of the CRTC, in its history since 1968, only one woman. Now, only one Indigenous representative has ever been appointed. Very few people of color have been appointed. The fact is that Canada still maintains in the media landscape centers of white power, and where there are women participating, it's white women like me. From your global experience, what have you seen in terms of the effectiveness of these mandates for gender equality when they're not followed up by evaluative practices or by policy that's informed by evaluative practices? It's one thing to pass a policy. It's another thing to put that policy into real action.
I hope that you didn't mind if I also invite my colleagues who are here with me. I have my head of policy here, who's an expert in some of the issues that we're discussing, also to contribute. But let me start by saying, when it comes into securing a place for people who are excluded, there is nothing like policy where there's repercussions for non-implementing. People do not voluntarily include people in cultures where there's deep history of exclusion. Laws will not make the people that have an attitude that exclude others to love the people that they want to exclude, but it could force them to do something they don't want to do because there's repercussions. And that is why quota systems in many countries where we have seen increase in the inclusion of people that would otherwise be included work. So where you have produced a report, where you have made strong suggestions about what needs to be done, where you have passed policy, I think it's important to have implemented quotas reinforced by recourse when the law is not being followed. Otherwise, depending on the goodness of people's heart, lets us down so often. I see it in many countries, and I think what you're explaining about Canada is very much similar to what you see in other countries. But when it comes into the world of broadcasting, where sometimes the written word has so much strength sometimes over oral traditions, the radio fraternity has a particular role to play by bringing the stories of the people who don't have to read and write for their stories to be heard. There's a lot of glamour that is associated with that, which starts by thinking that if you bring in a grassroots perspective into that world, it is not interesting enough. And we have to do battle against that, because that is also what determines whose presence is valued, who brings audience, and we get into, you know, viewership and all of that. And then as we do that, we actually include other people's authentic stories and histories. I've seen that in Brazil, country where the majority of the population is actually people of African descent. But when you look at who dominates the media, the visual and otherwise, you really see sprinkles of black people. It is only in those stations where people actually have made it a policy, given a quota and following up. Think of a country like South Africa, my country. We are a majority black country, but we have, for instance, music and content that comes from all over the world that has drowned local content. We have had to pass a law to actually secure a percentage for locally produced content in order to make sure that we do not subsume. And there's consequence for DJs, for presenters, for the head of station if they actually don't do that. So law must have teeth. I think that's the moral of the story. Laws must have teeth.
If I'm being completely real, sometimes I can be sitting in my office, and if, let's say, somebody who has never been to the station, who has never met any staff member, will walk into the main office, and they may see a black woman, a white male, and a white female, they will automatically first gravitate to the white male, whether or not they know if that is who they need for the request that they are asking or not. The second person they will gravitate to is the white female. The last person they will come to is me. We say that we want to get rid of the stereotypes and we want to get rid of the quote-unquote norms, but I feel, and this would be my question for you also, that people are comfortable in their stereotype. Just at the basic level, you will say to the man, you take out the trash, I'll do the dishes. Or these are too heavy for me, or something like that. Just at the basic level, subconsciously, we are comfortable with these stereotypes. My question will be, how do we deconstruct the comfort?
That's where Poorna comes in.
My name is Poorna Sen, I'm Director of Policy at UN Women. I think this conversation is really, really important, and I'll tell you why I think it's really timely. In essence, it's way overdue, but I think there's a frame in the world now and that governments have committed to that is really important for us. I just want to acknowledge that and then I want to come to the specifics. Last September, governments from across the world agreed a whole new set of objectives that they would try and reach for women and for everybody else. And that includes a commitment to leave nobody behind. If we're really going to leave nobody behind, these conversations about who have been left behind and why is absolutely crucial. There is the whole issue you've raised around Indigenous women, around race and black women. ED has mentioned about women with disabilities and older women. This is not just an opportunity, but an absolute obligation on states and governments now to address those histories which have been exclusionary. But it means we have to do some of the uncomfortable things about unpicking what people are comfortable with and challenging them on that, which is always, always very disruptive and difficult to do. And it meets a massive backlash and resistance. So what you're asking everybody to do is something that a lot of people are going to be very uncomfortable with. But I think we still have to do it. I think we absolutely have to do it. And ensuring that we have the voices of Indigenous women and Black women saying what their real experience is crucial. In a way, you don't get things to shift unless people are brave and say that. And being brave is a big step because there are always consequences. If you know you're the Black woman who says you're always ignoring me, you know that people are going to say you're just whinging or you're complaining. But you have to know now that there is a commitment, an obligation on states and activists and broadcasts and everybody else have to hold them to account on making this difference. And they're really ambitious about when they say they're going to make it all change, which is another 14 years. So make people uncomfortable. One of our colleagues, your deputy, Lakshmi Puri, talks about our task is disrupting the universe. And that's absolutely right. It's that scale of ambition. It's that commitment. And it's absolutely about making spaces where women who have traditionally and almost globally been left behind, been excluded, been silenced, been rendered invisible, to say what they need to say and to be safe in saying it so there aren't consequences for them. Two women are unsafe if they challenge a status quo. So we have to create the spaces and the conditions in which they can do that.
In this next clip, we learn about the value of community radio for its independence as a media source. We can be grateful in Canada to have such strong governmental support for community stations, but this is not the case throughout the world, even though the ideological foundation has been laid. Lila Doss, International Association of Women in Radio and Television Lifetime Achievement Award winner and former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, shares with us a comparative analysis of this freedom discovered during her time co-creating UN Radio.
I was lucky enough to be sent all over the world. I've worked for UN Radio in many, many places. But the most interesting, and we were talking about broadcasters, I remember how the whole setup was planned and worked out and the fights that went on, and I'm very intrigued because apparently a lot of this is still going on, about the role of information and the role of radio in the United Nations. And one of our biggest fights was, are we going to get transmitters? Are we going to get the world to give us the independence and the authority to broadcast from the United Nations? And I'll always remember, I think one of my most exciting days in my life was sitting in front of the transmitter in Studio 9, which I'm sure you know very well, announcing proudly, this is the United Nations calling the peoples of the world. I don't think they do it anymore. It's never said that way. And this was a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And then came the other part of it, because after you said that, then we had to say, and I used to say it in a very, very low voice, this transmission has been made possible by the voice of America. Or you have been listening to the United Nations through the voice of America. And we knew immediately how many radios were being turned off all around the world. And this was the fight we had from the very beginning. We had a wonderful proposal where we were going to have our own transmitters, and it was going to cost a magnificent sum all over the world, shortwave transmitters, of I think it was $1 million. And it was turned down. And there was a big debate right at the beginning, should the UN broadcast or not? What's wrong? We have the BBC, we have the Voice of America, we have all the other stations. Why does anybody need a United Nations station? And we couldn't convince the governments. In fact, as we went along, we realized the pressures of the governments, how fantastically strong, rigid regulations for reporting. You know that when we used to broadcast United Nations news, reports of what happened in the Security Council, for instance, we were not allowed to use adjectives or adverbs. Reporting from the United Nations in those days was like walking a tightrope with your hands clasped behind your back. We had to report each delegate in the same order in which they spoke. Never an adjective, never an adverb, and the same amount of space. And when I do a media course, I give my students a Security Council report on some very explosive issue. I give them the UN transcript of the UN radio program and then tell them to write it as if they were broadcasting from one side or the other. And it is fantastic to show them the difference from when one side is reporting and the other. To get a budget to put information into a development program was an enormous struggle. And then on top of that, to put into that development program information which would consult the people who are being assisted and not just governments, talking to the people who were being assisted and finding out if that's what they wanted. And very often it was not what they wanted at all. The UN Development Program built a hospital, I think it was in Nepal, and nobody used that hospital, nobody would go near it, because they discovered it had been built on holy ground, which nobody would go near. Nobody had consulted the people. And this time and time again, I've talked about it for a million times, when the people have not been consulted and the program just didn't work. And this was another issue, the whole effort to try and get information into this area, or even to get it into a UNDP development program at all, that we couldn't afford it. So then we went around begging, and I all remember going around begging, and not so long ago, going around country after country, asking for the use of transmitters. And we never were able to get, until today, our own transmitters. We have never been independent. Nobody wants the UN to be really absolutely independent.
We also do programs, you see, apart from the fact that they try to shy away from the recorder, sometimes we sit down and then we see some stories that the wives are the slaves on the farms. They are the people who do the farm work, they farm, yet it's the husbands who benefit. First, it is the woman who is supposed to request land from the husband. The husband will give the land out. She will go and do the clearing. Sometimes, if the husband is able to help her do the clearing, that's all. She will go and sow. She will go and then weed. She will go and apply fertilizer, if any. She will do everything. She will harvest and process. And then the husband will come and decide which ones to take to the market and which ones to maintain at home. And even when she's to take some to the market, it is the woman that will carry it and walk to the market, sit in the sun, sell, and at the end of the day, come and account the money and give it to the husband. And the husband will determine what the money should be used for. In fact, they benefit little from the work they do. It's culture. They tell you that, oh, they are our husbands. They own the house and the land. They don't understand what it is to have your own rights, to be somehow independent. They are still dependent on the husband because he is the family head and owns the family, and they don't really have a say. In a latest community meeting, we went with a village Domaje women, when we recorded their audios, and they said everything we do, we have to seek permission from our husbands. And if they say no, it is no. If they say yes, it is yes, because we ask them why. They say because they are our husbands. They own the house and they own us. They dowried us. So legally, the husband holds the woman in a way because he goes to pay the dowry of the woman. And the dowry is really something big, because if you are in your husband's house and your husband didn't dowry you, you are not his wife. So because of the dowry, culturally, it is legitimate, it is legal. You are legally a property of your husband. That is why in the marriage, the children belongs to the husband. And that is the patrilineal system. The woman accepted that, yes, it is our responsibility and everything the man does, he is right because he owns us. So because of this, many women want to save their marriages. So they accept whatever their husbands do to them. Your husband can even beat you and the next minute you still get up and follow him to the farm and work. But one thing the radio is really trying to do, especially with the Madame Rosalind, she helps us. We go into the community together.
Madame Rosalind is a gender expert.
Yes, she is a gender expert, and she has worked a lot on those issues. So now she comes and assists us. We go to the communities. We have community meetings, or when the women themselves are having their meetings, we go join them to give them education to know that they have their rights. At least we need to have gender equality. And most of them are responding positively to that. And right now, some say that, yes, they can now work a lot, get money to pay their children's school fees because that is their priority. And that is one way the radio is helping a woman out there.
There was a women's program in New York on WBAI. It was called 51%, the Women's News. And there were two women who were producing that together, and one of them had moved out to the Bay Area about 6 months before I got there. And they were the ones who had gotten me hooked on doing women's news. They'd called me up in Washington and asked me to go cover a story. When I went out there, I looked up Catherine Davenport, and we started doing a women's news project. This was in 1985 when I got there, and it was right at the end of the decade for women. There had been that huge conference in Nairobi, and NPR had refused to send me. Let me just say also that there had been a women's news movement that had started within community radio in the United States that I knew about. And also, I knew that there were women who had been doing women's radio and especially news internationally, because in Nairobi there was a peace tent, and the woman who funded the peace tent had called a women's radio meeting there. When Catherine and I decided to start Wings, we got the list of the women who had been at the peace tent with their contact information. And so we actually managed to get a small grant too, and we used that to contact these women and to produce a pilot for the show. So we wrote to the women, and some of them sent things, and then we produced the pilot, and then some more women sent things. And then there was stuff coming in, so Catherine and I decided we would just keep producing it at least once a month. But what was behind it was, and behind the whole women's news movement, was, you know, that there was so little about women in the media, and it was so poor. I remember I was watching a current affairs show called McNeil Lehrer News Hour. They were a very well-known public television show, and they had a man who was doing the interviewing and another man who was a Sovietologist. The interviewer was asking him questions about different people who had been elected to the Politburo of the Soviet Union. And the interviewer says, oh, and there was a woman who was elected. But they said, oh, that was the first woman in 25 years. And before the man could even open his mouth to say anything about her, the interviewer said, oh, and what about so-and-so, and just moved right on and didn't say anything about that woman. So I said, we're going to get something about that woman. I mean, this was a time when Soviets and Americans really weren't allowed to talk to each other. But on International Women's Day, there was a woman who came from the Soviet consulate to speak on International Women's Day. Catherine and I went and recorded the proceedings, and afterwards I got hold of her. I said, listen, we want to get an interview with Alexandra Biryakova. She said, well, here, I'll tell you how to do it. You write to this man. Suddenly, we got a package in the mail. It was an interview with Alexandra Biryakova. The man had said, well, what questions do you want to ask? Send a list of the questions. They had asked all of our questions and translated it and sent it on this little reel. It was so funny because it had a hub that didn't fit on our tape players. We had a hell of a time getting it off so that we could play it, because in Eastern Europe they had a different kind of machinery. One time we just called up the Swedish National Radio and said we wanted to talk to a woman reporter. The woman who answered said, well, I'm a woman reporter. And we said, well, what's the hot news about women in Sweden? She said, well, there's a new American diet plan. We said, no, no, that's not what we mean. And she said, well, actually, there was a story and nobody has covered it. She said, all the women in the parliament from all the different parties got together across party lines to propose a bill that would decriminalize women as prostitutes and criminalize the men who buy the prostitution. So that was a story that we ran very early in Wings. Well, 12 years after that, we ran the story that they had succeeded in passing that bill. And just recently, last year, on Wings, we had a woman who is a spokesperson for the Swedish government who goes around explaining the Swedish prostitution law and how effective it is and how the rest of the countries should follow suit. So it's a story that we've covered from its very inception, you know, up until today when it's being promoted throughout the world. That was one of the main reasons that we started an international program at that time because they said, you know, these ties have been made and we don't want them to forget what they learned, and we want to use the sympathy that women have developed for each other to try to open up the eyes of people in the United States to the fact that there are other countries and that they have issues, some of which are caused by things that go on in the United States, you know. So that was a piece of it. But the global women's movement has really grown in scope. You know, it has incorporated a lot of different movements over time. In 1989, I covered a women's development conference at which DAWN, Development Alternatives with Women in a New Era, which was a group of intellectual feminists from countries of the South, they took over that conference. It was a conference that took place in the United States, and they took it over, and they laid their vision out, and it has completely changed AWID, Association for Women in Development. They don't even call it the same name anymore. But they were talking about structural adjustment, and that was the first time that I had heard this, how the World Bank would go in and destroy the economy of these countries by forcing people to be laid off from government jobs, by cutting education, by, you know, doing all these things, and how hard this was making life for women. And so women were like kind of canaries in the coal mine, but also there were women intellectuals in the South who were understanding these things and laying them out very early. Another thing that very early came out of the women's movement, well, you know, in 1990, I think it was 91, there were two women's environment conferences that took place in Miami, Florida, international women's environment conferences. And the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet had a tribunal about women and the environment. So this was a moment when the women's movement sort of formally embraced the environment as a feminist issue. And Vanda Nashiva was there. She gave the most amazing speech about Terminator seed technology and the attempt to destroy the self-reproducing nature of seeds in order to profit. It was totally brilliant. So we see that the globalization movement, the environmental movement, these kinds of things are coming out of the women's movement. One of the earliest interviews that we had for Wings was an interview with Helen Caldicott talking about how the Physicians for Social Responsibility had forced her out of the organization shortly before they won the Nobel Prize. So you can see that there is a problem of who gets the credit for stuff. But yes, by following women's ideas throughout the world, listening to what they have to say, I mean, it's just such an incredible education that I've been able to get and to share with other people. It's amazing.
Across Canada, regionally, the treatment of women is so diverse. If you look at our missing and murdered Indigenous Women's Commission that we couldn't even get successfully accomplished under our last government, there is areas of disparity, gender violence, violence against women, and it's something that one neighbor could have a family where the women are the leaders of that family and are lauded and applauded and given every opportunity, where right next door somebody could be being abused or worse. So it's an interesting culture to study gender parity. If we look at our mainstream media industry in Canada, the amount of images that are broadcast of women, women being raped, women being brutalized, sodomized, abused, it's an epidemic in our country, and these companies profit off these images, and our government then in turn makes taxes from these organizations who are propagating this horrendous imagery hour after hour, day after day in our country. Certainly, I'm most proud of the work that I've done in the NCRA, and I've met Gretchen over 10 years ago on that Women's Hands and Voices panel where we put in place a woman's constitution for this organization that allowed for safe spaces, that allowed for childcare. If a woman broadcaster wanted to participate, she had access to childcare through our policy. And this year, to answer to your concern, we've created a harassment policy and a grievance process, which is amazing because women in this country, we shrug it off, we laugh it off. We're discriminated against based on our gender all the time, and we have this amazing, gracious attitude towards it. But I will say, ultimately, there is no sacred space for women, and I think we could combat some of that. And I would really love to see more sacred women's space, spaces by women and for women, which this country is sorely lacking.
If you have these problems in Canada, can you imagine what's happening in Pakistan, what's happening in Mali. That is also a reason for us to think about global sisterhood, because the challenges are truly universal. Women from different parts of the world have similar experience, slightly different and maybe context specific, but you can connect the dots most of the time. And it is only when women are able to work together that we are able to actually shake the system. And because our governments belong to a community of practice called the United Nations, they sign to agreements, they commit to do certain things. We all have a responsibility to hold them accountable, to make sure that they use the powers vested in them to actually make these changes. One of the most important things when you're dealing with these issues that are both systemic and intergenerational is actually to work with both men and women in this context, young and old. We cannot stop talking about these things. In Portuguese, there is the slogan, a luta continua, the struggle continues, we just have not arrived. These struggles that we have inherited from the giants on whose shoulders we stand are still relevant today, maybe a little bit different, but also we must give ourselves time to celebrate some of the breakthroughs that we have so that we do not also beat ourselves so much that we're discouraged, we lack the energy to move to the next. We need to give ourselves a break and use the successes that we have to spare us on.
हम आपके लिए लेकर आए हैं कार्यक्रम हमारी बेड़ियां। इस कार्यक्रम में मैं अनीता आप सभी का स्वागत करती हूं। कार्यक्रम हमारी बेड़ियां एक प्रयास, एक कोशिश है समाज में फैली कुरीतियों तथा परंपराओं को उजागर करने और मिटाने का। श्रोताओं, लोग माओं, बीवियों और प्रेमिकाओं से मोहब्बत करते हैं तो फिर बेटियां क्यों कत्ल कर दी जाती हैं?
It is the stories that carry the change, because the stories are the life, and it's in the life that the change takes place.
Und das darf man nicht vergessen, gerade zu Beginn der 90er Jahre, die brutalen Frauenrechtsverletzungen in Kriegen. Also wir erinnern uns an die Massenvergewaltigungen im ehemaligen Jugoslawien 92 und auch 94, also in den bewaffneten Konflikten in Ruanda. Und das war erstmalig, dass Massenvergewaltigung als Kriegstaktik auch medial, also sehr, sehr publik gemacht worden sind und wo es einen immensen öffentlichen Druck gegeben hat, hier auch adressiert an die Vereinten Nationen, also Frauenrechte zu stärken und mehr zum Schutz von Frauen zu unternehmen, um sie eben vor diesen brutalen Übergriffen besser schützen zu können. Und ich glaube, das sind auch Resultate.
It's been a pleasure being your host on this extended version of our important conversation that merely scratches the surface to present but a few of the ways community radio broadcasters have been able to and must continue to serve the international women's movement. When it comes to effecting long-term and progressive changes to a culture that has oppressed the voice of a significant population, the value of including first-hand accounts based on experience cannot be undermined. A special thank you goes out to the work of UN Women, WINGS, the NCRA ANRAC, and AMARC, whose online archive allowed me to capture the clips you heard of women's voices broadcasting in their own language via community radio programs. To wrap this feature, we asked Fumzile if she could offer final thoughts.
As people who are in the radio space, which is the medium of communication, it's a privilege for you to be in this, which means that therefore there's responsibility on you to use this medium to change the world. Some people will use the barrel of a gun to force their ideas on other people. You can use your spoken word to change, to reach, to influence. Every day when you stand in front of the microphone and you open your mouths, you must just know that this just could be the day when you change someone's life. Take the space. I think the world, by and large, is ready and need people like yourselves. So go there and just make a difference.
How I was taught, we don't have a word for goodbye in Anishinaabe Mwen. So what we say is Bama Pi Goabmen. That means see you again and hope you are well.